Welcome to Australia's Future with Tony Abbott. I'm Daniel Wilde from the Institute of Public Affairs. Australia is facing its most significant challenges since World War II. Geopolitical tensions are increasing, cultural self-confidence is in decline. The values which define us, freedom, democracy, egalitarianism, and sacrifice, are being put to the test. Over this special podcast series, Tony and I discuss how Australia can survive and flourish in the decades ahead. Well, hello, Tony, and g'day to all of our listeners. Great to be back for another episode of Australia's Future with Tony Abbott. Today, Tony will be sharing his insights on the concerning rise of anti-Semitism in Australia and other parts of the world. We'll be discussing the decline, at least in the polls, of the Albanese government and also the international situation as it pertains to the Middle East, Ukraine and China. Tony, great to be back chatting with you.
Dan, thanks for having me. It's been great talking this year and I look forward to keeping it up next year.
Great, likewise. So let's kick off with this concerning rise of what appears to be anti-Semitism in Australia with the rallies or protests, if you like, regarding Palestine. We've seen that with school children and, of course, a number of weeks ago, the events in Sydney at the Opera House. I think this has taken a lot of Australians by surprise. It's concerning. And to me, this has no place whatsoever in our country. I'm very interested in your thoughts and perspective on the current situation.
Well, Dan, obviously what happened in Israel on October the 7th was an utter atrocity. It was an act of extraordinary and unprecedented barbarity. And the difference between the Hamas terrorists and the Nazi killers of a couple of generations back is that the Nazis at least tried to hide what they were doing, whereas these Hamas terrorists were simulcasting it all on social media. Look, Dad, I've just killed 10 Jews, this kind of thing. So it was utterly depraved and sickening. But in a sense, almost as disconcerting, because we've long known that Hamas were effectively a death cult, almost as disconcerting was the response on the streets of Western cities. Now, nowhere was it more shocking than in Sydney, where we had large crowds outside the Opera House chanting a slogan, which I'm not even going to repeat. It was so disgusting. Apparently exultant at what Hamas had done. And this happened before there'd even been any significant retaliation by the Israeli Defence Forces. So what we've got is a situation where we have been reminded of Islamist extremism and the dangers that it poses to normal, liberal, pluralist democracies. Mm-hmm. We've also been alerted to the fact that in our midst are some people who perhaps for tribal reasons feel deeply hostile to the state of Israel and to Jewish people, and others who don't have any, if you like, tribal reason to be hostile to Israel and to Jews, but who for ideological reasons identify Jewish people with white privilege and identify Israel with colonial oppression. So it's a combination of poorly integrated migrants who are spending too much time dwelling on the issues of their former homeland, with cultural Marxists who are rampant in our education system. And then I suppose there's the general problem of people who are trying to correct the past. Well, we can't correct the past. All we can do is make today and tomorrow better. And this idea that we should dwell on something that happened seven decades ago, which cannot be undone, rather than trying to make the most of the circumstances of today and make tomorrow better, it's just wrong. And yet it seems to be deeply prevalent, particularly amongst the Islamic peoples of the Middle East. So we've got some problems, and I suppose at least we're aware of them, which is the start of dealing with them.
Yeah. What's so interesting to me about this is it really also tests, I guess, the boundaries of some of the principles that we have, for instance, freedom of speech and freedom of assembly, mm-hmm. where clearly we want to live in a society where people are free to assemble and make their case. Mm-hmm. But there's a boundary to what is permissible mm-hmm. in that. And I think a lot of the things that have been said at these events should not be allowed, frankly, in our society, because they're such a significant departure from our values. I'm just interested in your perspective, Tony, on that boundary. And as I say, we must be a nation of where people can assemble, but to do so in a manner that's hectoring your fellow citizen, to me, seems like a bridge too far.
Well, 2 points there, Dan. First of all, I'm a free speech advocate, as you'd expect, but free speech has never been licensed to say anything. And we do have laws against hate speech. Mm-hmm. They have been enthusiastically prosecuted against cartoonists and newspaper columnists who've offended more fashionable groups. Mm-hmm. But it seems that the giant anti-racist bureaucracy that we've built up has been remarkably slow to take action against the hate preachers and the crowds chanting these hate-filled slogans on our streets. So I think we should prosecute these hate preachers, and we should take action against people who, however carried away they might have been, did do something which does, I think, deeply offend the normal standards of Australian society. Mm. Then there's the issue of protest. Now, people have a right to protest, no doubt about that. They don't have an unlimited right to disrupt. Mm. And I've always felt that things like Extinction Rebellion, where you've got a few dozen people trying to close down a city by gluing themselves to roads or by riding bicycles very slowly across the Harbour Bridge or something like that, they aren't legitimate protests. They are damaging and sometimes dangerous disruptions which are preventing everyone else from going about the normal business of the day. And
yep.
people do not have a right to protest in ways that seriously disrupts everyone else's ordinary enjoyment of life. So I think we've been too permissive mm-hmm. of hate speech against the Jews, and I think we've been too permissive of these anti-Semitic protests which have been roiling our cities for several weeks now.
Yeah, no, it's an important distinction to make, I think, Tony. And, you know, talking about the federal government and their response to this, I think it's been pretty weak overall. I would say that Albanese himself has been relatively clear, took too long. But that has certainly contributed to the decline in the polls, mm-hmm. among many other factors. It's been a pretty sharp turnaround from the coalition. And we were just talking before we hit record about, you know, Peter Dutton's comments that he wants to win in one term. And yeah. you've had a lot of experience in this. You won over two terms, but you wanted to win.
Of course.
In one term, and you almost got
almost
there.
Almost did in 2010. And
it was a remarkable, I think one of the most remarkable turnarounds we've seen in Australian political history. So just interested in your perspective on that.
Well, Dan, look, we effectively won the election, but unfortunately we lost the negotiation with those former National Party turned quasi-green independents, Oakeshott and Windsor. But yes, you've absolutely got to aim to win. No point going onto the field for a game of rugby or indeed any sport if you don't intend to win, and frankly, if you don't think you can win. So good on Peter Dutton for his forward-leaning approach here. And look, I think the Albanese government is in quite a degree of trouble. I think the Prime Minister has obviously been a little shell-shocked since the Voice defeat.
Yep.
And I think the basic problem is that so many of the things that the government's doing right now are making our problems worse, not better. We've often commented on the energy policy train wreck. Mm. The government's workplace relations policies, largely dictated to it by the union movement, are certainly making it harder to lift productivity, which is essential for our long-term prosperity. As patriots, we should want governments to succeed, even the governments that we haven't voted for. But it is, I suppose, an opportunity for the coalition, if the coalition can be a clear alternative. And I guess the really encouraging thing about the year we've we've almost ended,
mm-hmm.
is the fact that when presented with a choice between what looked like political expediency and what was clearly the right thing to do over the voice, Peter Dutton chose the right thing to do. When the coalition first committed to oppose the voice, it was roughly 60-40 in favour, if the opinion polls are to be believed. We all know it ended up 60-40 against. And the fact that the opposition leader and others were able to argue a principled case and in so doing turn something that looked like a political loser into a political winner should give the coalition a great deal of confidence. And hopefully on other issues such as energy, such as immigration, such as superannuation for housing and so on, the opposition will now have more courage of its convictions.
Yeah, and I think that that point about leadership is something that we've talked about, and I think you as opposition leader were an exemplar of that because, you know, the carbon tax was a fait accompli, you know, had to be on the right side of history. If you had polling, Australians would say, yes, we must do something about climate change. But when you debated the issue, you said, okay, but what about the cost? What about industry? What about jobs? What about the back pocket? So it's leading people and having a debate and getting them to understand that these things have real costs.
You've got to be prepared to pick a fight. To make a difference, you've got to be prepared to pick a fight, to go into battle on something. You've got to have a good argument. But yes, there's got to be political leadership. I mean, you and I can persuade our listeners perhaps that a particular course of action is the right way forward. But unless someone in a position of political authority is then prepared to say, well, yes, I'm prepared to buy into that fight, have that battle and take it forward into practical change, well, nothing much does change. And the whole point, I think, of life in big ways and in small ways, is to try to make things better, whether it's in our family, in our personal lives, with our neighbours, in our communities, with our country, with our world. The point, if we are to be the people we should be, is to try to make change for the better. Now, if you're a conservative, you think that change for the better is often restoration rather than reform, and is invariably, at least in a country like ours, building on our strengths, but nevertheless, complacent acceptance of what is when what is plainly is suboptimal is no way to live.
One thing that's been really interesting is I think in many ways Albanese has been sort of exposed in a way. So those of us who watch politics closely have always known that Albanese is fairly far to the left and that he's fundamentally energised by cultural issues. But he sort of hid that in the 2022 campaign. But now it's sort of out in the open with his agenda of voice, treaty, truth and wanting a republic. And it's what has opened up is a big dichotomy or split between the left-leaning Labor leadership in Canberra and sort of the old Labor right voters, who are basically now without a political home. And that must be surely the target group of the coalition as they head into 2025. Drawing on your experience, you won over a lot of Labor voters, Tony's tradies, those kind of people. What's your perspective on what the coalition could do to win those voters? You've mentioned things such as migration and other such matters. Could you elaborate on that a bit?
Sure, Dan. I mean, when I was the party leader, I used to say that our party was the Freedom Party, it's the Tradition Party, but above all else, it's the Patriotic Party.
Mm-hmm.
I think freedom is very important, but not everyone is a classical liberal, let alone a libertarian. I think tradition is very important, but a lot of people aren't really as invested in the study of the past and learning from it as I am. But I think most of the people who live in this country, unlike the cultural Marxists who dominate the education system, most of the people who live in this country in their bones appreciate that it is a great place to live and don't like the suggestion that it isn't and are wary of radical change mm-hmm. that they think could put at risk the things that have always animated the Australian way. And this was the problem with The Voice. We'd been told for two centuries, rightly, that the whole point of Australia is everyone is equal and everyone should get a fair go, particularly people who have a go. And The Voice was going to create two classes of citizens. It was going to offend against Bob Hawke's illustrious dictum that in this country there's no hierarchy of descent, there's no privilege of origin. And that was why the vast majority of people, all of whom want only what's best for Aboriginal people, said no to The Voice. It wasn't saying no to some benign form of constitutional recognition, but it was saying no to this quite radical change mm-hmm. to our system of government and quite radical change to the way we think about ourselves. I mean, a lot of The Voice supporters thought, oh, this is just going to be like same-sex marriage. Yeah. The Conservatives will get swept away. But at least superficially, same-sex marriage was about achieving equality, whereas this was about establishing inequality, which is why I think the public took, in the end, almost the polar opposite view on those two subjects. So you're right. A lot of people feel politically homeless. And I think the traditional working class are probably the most homeless group at the moment. On the one hand, the Green Left Labor Party can't really be for them. But on the other hand, they aren't quite convinced that the coalition is for them in the way that it might have been under John Howard, in the way that I certainly tried to make it when I was the party leader. The people who voted no, if I can generalise, were broadly socially conservative and I suspect broadly economically pragmatic. And what they're looking for in the coalition is a sense that we will take their concerns seriously and we will come up with practical ways of dealing with them. But I can certainly see some very politically prospective ways for the coalition to appeal very broadly to a lot of discontented Labor voters at the next election.
Yeah, well, we'll be watching with interest, I think, and talking about this a lot more over the coming months. Tony, how about we turn to our last topic today, which is on the international scene. There's obviously building tensions in Middle East, Ukraine, the constant threat and challenge of China. Just interested in your latest assessment of the situation that we're facing and what we might be able to do more of to ameliorate some of these challenges.
Well, there's no doubt it is a much more perilous world today than we thought it was just a few years ago. And you've mentioned the three most ominous hotspots. I think it's important that the democracies don't let Ukraine down because Ukraine continues to be fighting for the freedom of everyone, not just itself. And while the Ukrainians did not achieve the quick knockout blow that a lot of people perhaps unrealistically expected from the summer counteroffensive, they have made steady incremental progress. And if they continue to be supported, I think they can continue to make incremental progress. One of the problems is that so far they've been given the weaponry not to lose, but they haven't been given the weaponry needed to win, and I do think that needs to change. The Middle East is always deeply problematic, but it is a deeply unstable situation, and the Iranians and their proxies are constantly testing what they can get away with, as indeed are the Chinese in the South China Sea and elsewhere. The most recent example, of course, was the Chinese warship that deliberately injured Australian sailors by turning on its sonar. Now, the only thing that bullies understand is strength. Israel has survived because it has responded fiercely to any significant attack on it. We will only preserve what's left of the global liberal order by responding firmly to any attempts to further destabilize it. If Taiwan is to remain effectively a free and democratic society, well, the commissars in Beijing need to understand that any assault on Taiwan would not be 1.4 billion Chinese against 25 million Taiwanese. It would effectively be China versus the world. Because while I have no doubt that the Beijing regime can't wait to gobble Taiwan up, I don't believe they're irrational, and I don't believe they would do something that would pose all sorts of risks to them. So let's hope that in the coming year, the democracies are strong of mind and stronger materially. That means not inflicting economic self-harm through things like misguided climate policy, and more urgently, building up the industrial base that's needed to sustain the kind of military that would be a credible opposition to anything that dictatorships can throw at us.
Yeah, and Tony, just to close on, because I know you've got a race off to catch a flight, there's a lot of changes happening in the not just the Western world, but more broadly, that I think some of which are quite positive. We can see, I think, positive developments in Canada. There's a big change in Argentina. We'll see how that plays out. I think in Italy, France, Netherlands, we've just seen now. These are not unalloyed goods, but we're clearly seeing, I think, if not a majority, a significant minority of citizens in these countries that are resisting the overtures of the elites on many of these policies as well. So I think it's a very dynamic, fast-changing time, including here in Australia. Yeah. So I'm hopeful and confident that if the right people are able to make the right moves at this time, that we could see some very positive change and development. So just to round out, just interested in your reflections
on that. Look, I think that's right, Dan. But the challenge is to convert transient political success into sustained better government. And what we saw with Donald Trump in the United States was that he did tend to get a bit swallowed up inside the swamp. What we saw with Boris Johnson and others in Britain was that the administrative state ambushed them and sabotaged them at every turn, and Boris didn't always help himself with some of his own policies and actions. Let's see how these new governments in Italy and Argentina and elsewhere go. The thing we always used to talk about in the Howard era was that it's one thing to have a policy, it's another thing to be able to implement it.
Yeah.
And it's the implementation challenge, given that there's now even more institutional opposition than there was then to what might broadly be described as sensible, centre-right, patriotic policies. And this is where you don't just need passion, conviction, courage and enthusiasm. You also need the administrative skill and the, I suppose, steady, methodical, just getting on with it on a day-by-day basis, which I'm afraid not all political leaders have.
No, I think it'll be very interesting, and we'll see how we go over the next couple of years. But Tony, we'll leave it there so you can get off to your flight, and greatly appreciate your time and insights as always, and we'll chat again soon.
As always, Dan, a pleasure to be with you.
This is a production of the Centre for the Australian Way of Life at the Institute of Public Affairs. To find out more, visit australia.ipa.org.au.